Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes to my guest. In this case, somebody I have known for a very long time. I think we'll trace it, but at least a half century. Dennis Kucinich, well known to anybody listening to this, is a guy who was a member of Congress for 16 years. He ran for president. He's been a public intellectual as well as a political person, politician. But when I first met him, he was described throughout the mass media on TV and what have you as the boy mayor of Cleveland. And I went and interviewed him for the Los Angeles Times. I interviewed him for a Playboy interview, which I think destroyed his chances of reelection for the more conservative community there in Cleveland. I don't know, being in Playboy, maybe I'm wrong. But he's no stranger to controversy. One of the few that has voted against war in the U.S. Congress and even wanted a Department of Peace. But he just published an article on his Substack that I reprinted on SharePost that is really shows, to my mind, a certain political courage that ought not to require courage to make such a statement. It's a very strong criticism of Israel's conduct of this war in Gaza. I'll let him summarize the charge of this column. But reading it, I felt like, kryptonite in my hand or something. I feel like, wait a minute, what is the consequence? We live in a time when the U.S. Congress, that Dennis used to be a member of, has decided that any criticism of Israel is by definition anti-Semitic. And even if you're a traditional Orthodox Jewish person who thinks it was not a secular decision that should bring back Israel, it should be a larger power, an almighty, that brings it back. But the fact of the matter is, we're in a very strange, off with their heads attitude to anybody on any college campus, even Harvard, let us say, who dares object to the policies of a government, the state of Israel. And Dennis's objection in this column is very strong. I'll let him describe it, and then let's talk about the fear that exists, the legal consequence of daring to challenge, and what this has done to our First Amendment, our freedom of the press, freedom of speech. Take it away, Dennis.
Thanks very much, Bob, for this chance to discuss the article that I've posted on Substack and on SharePost concerning war dust, concerning the ecological and health effects of war. To begin with, war is ecocide. It always has been. It's just even more devastating now because of the types of munitions that are being used and the circumstances in which they're being used. In the case of Gaza, Israel has dropped 100,000 tons of bombs on Gaza, on not just buildings, but on tents that were supposed to represent safe areas. Now, what I did in the article was to go very deeply into the destructive power of each bomb. And by the way, the bombs and the planes generally come from the United States. So the U.S. doesn't have, by any means, any clean hands here. We're instrumental. And in my view, in a genocide. But what I did, I focused very tightly on the destructive power of these various munitions that come from the U.S. that are being dropped on the people of Gaza. And what happens is 2,000-pound bombs, for example, if someone is close to the dropping of one, the human body is vaporized. In addition to that, the buildings, building materials, concrete, rebar, steel, can also be turned into dust. What that dust migrates. The environment, the atmosphere doesn't really have any boundaries, no geographical boundaries. The wind just takes that right into Israel. It takes the human remains, the DNA, the torn DNA particles, the dust, the metals, the cadmium, nickel, lead, all kinds of chemical metallic substances that are in the bombs themselves, all that drifts. And the point that I made is that Israelis are inhaling this. And the health consequences to people in Israel, you know, we know about the consequence to people in Gaza. They're getting killed. And if they survive, they're going to, their health will be, physical and mental, will be severely damaged for forever.
They've been turned into lethal dust.
Yeah,
and we're now not talking about the destruction of human beings, be they 2 years old or 80 years old, be they men, women, or be they combatants, or they, as with the vast majority, not. We're talking about they're dead or seriously maimed or what have you. But we're talking about what happens. They've been turned into lethal dust. And your article pointed out that then comes to, it's not just the victim of the bombing, it's the bombers' culture, people that are now at risk.
Well, right, and it cannot be anti-Semitic to raise concerns about the health effects of war on the people of Israel itself. I mean, I've in a previous column that was posted on Substack called The Crossing of Pieta, also posted on SurePost, I pointed out the effects on the people of Gaza of the war. In this one, I point out the effects of war on the people of Israel, but it goes beyond that because the wind will carry this across the Middle East. It can, you know, depending on which way the wind blows, hundreds, even thousands of miles. This raises a bigger question, and that is, who, you know, isn't it time that we started to discuss that there is very, ultimately, there's very little separation between the oppressed and the oppressors, between the victims and the aggressors, that they all are part of a resonance of a common human sphere, of a common environment. And when you wage war against someone, you're actually waging war against yourself. That's the deeper proposition here. It's not just philosophical. It's not just metaphysical. It is a physical fact that when people wage war against a country that's proximate, it is incontrovertible that the detritus of that war is going to be visited to people, not only in the air, but in the water, in the land, on the food. And so the deeper question I pose in this article, Bob, why do we even have war? I mean, how this whole idea challenges the war consciousness. And really what I'm trying to do is open up the discussion about the broader consequences of war on all the participants, on the combatants, the non-combatants, on people who are thousands of miles away. And this is a discussion certainly that we need to have that was started with somebody like Jonathan Schell years ago, when he spoke about nuclear winter and the danger of nuclear war. So I'm introducing this discussion now. And these are all verifiable facts. I mean, I had 23 different citations of scientific studies that I plumbed and in comparisons with 9/11 and Manhattan and with soldiers in the Gulf War, in the first Gulf War, and how they suffered effects from that. We don't pay enough attention to this. You know, we wage war with such certainty, but then mindlessly avoid any consideration of consequences. And so I'm talking about consequences.
Yeah, let me introduce more of your background. You actually, in Congress during your 16 years, tried to get a Department of Peace. We euphemistically call our War Department, the Department of Defense. It's not. It's a department generally of aggressive war, wars on other people, and wars basically on civilian. Some, you know, Rob McNamara, our Secretary of Defense, admitted to U.S. War in Vietnam at an early stage, having killed over 3.5 million people. The number probably rose to 5 million for Indochina. But you try to get a Department of Peace. The mass media never took that seriously. And people even argue whether it should be called a Department of Defense. Why not call it a Department of Offense or so forth? But it's really at the heart of it, a way it's propaganda to make it seem like there it's not war on humans, and it is war on humans. A 2,000-pound bomb, that's what else is it? I mean, it's, you can't have a specific target. You're going to kill lots of other people who was ever there in that area.
Well, those targets, they're being specifically dropped on tents. And, you know, there's nothing left. People just get annihilated.
Really a question, frankly, of courage. How do we stop? How do we discuss this? You were in Congress for 6 years. It's not your fault, of course. You were a rare voice for peace. But the fact of the matter is, the U.S. Congress, you can blame the Republican leadership, but the fact of the matter is plenty of Democrats support this. And they actually have taken the position that there's something special about Israel, and yes, and there's something special about its claim to be a Jewish state, that means that anything they do is by definition anti-Semitic and defined as a crime. Anything you criticize. And this is such an extreme attack on two points of the Constitution, the freedom of speech, of a press, yes, but also the freedom of religion. Because after all, you know, and I am a Jewish person. I lost half of my family in Lithuania that was Jewish. The other half, yes, I'm from a German Protestant family. I have to ask myself, how in the world can Germany now, and Donald Trump, who has all a German background, in the name of stopping the anti-Semitism that came to our consciousness because of the barbarism of Germany, now destroy the people of Gaza who have no army, no air force, no big mechanization, basically destroying a civilian population. And if you dare question the value of it, the morality of it, you know, the purpose of it, somehow it gets linked with historic anti-Semitism of this sophisticated military machine of Nazi Germany against Jews and others. You know, there are, after all, tens of millions of Slavic people killed and so forth. I want to ask you about this decision of Congress. And now here's this president, you know, he doesn't look back and blame his own ethnic ancestors in Germany. Somehow it's all visited upon Palestinians and on Palestinian civilians. So I want to, it has two prongs to this, a denial of the humanity of anybody who's a Palestinian, but also a denial of the U.S. responsibility and Israel responsibility. We are obviously arming them to not engage in genocide. And you use that word. And if you actually use that word, the president has a off with their heads. By definition, you're an enemy of America, of humanity, you're anti-Semitic. There's something grotesque about this, and I want you to put yourself back in Congress. Why are so few of the people in Congress willing to address this obvious hypocrisy?
Well, you know, first of all, the you know, having served 16 years in Congress, I saw, even from the beginning of my career, the great sensitivity for and support of Israel by members of Congress. And, you know, I'd say initially it came from the same historic concern that people worldwide had about the plight of Jews in World War II who were subject to the Holocaust and who Hitler and his henchmen tried to wipe off the face of the earth. That is such a graphic and burned into memory cultural awareness that that I think everyone who's alive and particularly those who are older today have, that you don't need much more than the awareness of that to cause you to want to be sympathetic to Israel. So then let's submit that. Now let's go to the next level. We have to understand that every country has its own politics, but the U.S. and Israel have had a rather unique relationship, especially you know, when you go back to the formation of Israel, and then you go to how Palestinians were at the very beginning subject to Nakba and getting ejected from the land in order to create space. One must be aware of that history. The as sympathetic as we must be for what Israel experienced in at the hands of Hitler in World War II, that sympathy does not in any way create impunity for the government of Israel to impose on the people of Gaza and the West Bank a ethnic cleansing, genocide itself, clearing land, stealing homes, a litany of usurpations and oppression. Anti-Semitism itself has been redefined, as we know, and then it's been weaponized. Once the effort was made to say that Palestinians are no longer Semitic, I mean, how that happens, you know, does violence to epistemology, to history, but it was a political move. Okay, so Palestinians are no longer Semitic. Then you start to justify going after the Palestinians because they're not Semitic anymore. And anything that is done to resist the attack on the Palestinians and on Gazans, anti-Semitic, ipso facto. Well, not really. I mean, this whole thing is about an inversion of meaning. And if people don't see it, well, they'll see it sooner or later. This is strictly Orwellian, the way that right becomes wrong and worse becomes the better reason. And when it comes to standing by and watching a full-blown genocide where you can't even have an honest body count because people are being vaporized, one must ask, what is the United States about? What is Israel about? What is our moral responsibility to put an end to this violence and to bring those who are responsible for it to justice?
Let me push a little harder on this because, first of all, a significant group of people that are being losing their jobs, being threatened with all sorts of things to put, are Jewish. There is a considerable amount of criticism in among the Jewish community of the world, including, unfortunately not as many as one had expected from previous experience in Israel itself. But the fact of the matter is, this charge that criticism of the government of Israel by definition is anti-Semitic deprives Jewish people. This is a point I make that it doesn't seem to register with anybody. It deprives Jewish people of their right to interpret their religion, pursue their religion according to their view and not Donald Trump's view. The irony here is we actually have to turn to some Christian groups that weren't very understanding of Jewish rights. After all, the attack, the pogroms, the killing of 6 million Jews was largely defended. Yes, there were Christians who opposed it, but in Germany, the Catholic establishment, the Protestant establishment certainly went along with this. And so this irony here of Jews at Columbia University who happen to be students protest what Israel is doing in their name, they can be kicked out of school, they can be arrested, they can lose their status. And so I don't understand why freedom of religion does not apply to Jewish people who say, wait a minute, Israel is misinterpreting our view, my view of what it means to be Jewish.
As I've reviewed this, I just want to go back to a fundamental statement here about why I'm involved in this. I'm opposed to war. I see war as a racket. I don't see war in this modern age as having any instrumentality other than the profits of the people that are selling the weapons and maybe the secondary benefit to those who have a political agenda. I oppose the violence that Hamas visited upon Israel. I opposed anyone visiting violence on Israel. But I also oppose the violence that have been done to the Palestinians. So let's go back to, and to people globally. I reject the idea of the necessity of war. Now let's get into people who are Jews who do oppose what's happening. They do it on religious reasons. They separate Judaism from Zionism, which, if anybody's aware of the history of Judaism and the history of Zionism, it's not that difficult to do. But the government of Netanyahu, for political purposes, is of course trying to combine the two for the purposes of shielding some of his own dark interests in ethnic cleansing and in genocide. There is a miasma and a confluence of thinking here that is so destructive. And my concern, Bob, is that if we don't challenge this, not just the war dust, but the consciousness that created this war and continues it and approves it and sanctions those who oppose it, if we don't challenge it, we are opening the door for a new epoch as America, in which we celebrate destruction of other people. And it's a very dangerous moment for America. And the suffering of the Palestinians and the Gazans, the people in the West Bank, is a warning to us. And we cannot stand by. We're participating even as observers. If you think of the Heisenberg principle, everybody's participating who watches it. But the question is, do you do anything? Do you say anything? Do you challenge this type of thinking, which I see as destructive of all humanity? We cannot be detached from this. And so the Jews that are coming forward and saying, look, don't put this on us. We disagree with this approach. I can also understand those in Israel who support the approach because fear has been so driven into a population that people are in a survival mode. They feel, well, this is what they have to do to survive. When that happens, oh my God, we then are at the advent of the licensing of a slaughter that can only multiply and spread across the world. So I opened up the discussion with talking about breathing in the death and the physical, the health effects, the psychological effects, the spiritual effects of all this, and to bring this discussion forward. And I appreciate this chance to do it with you, Bob.
Yeah, and I should correct myself in presenting this. You did write two articles. And the first article, which you had on Substack and was reprinted in SharePost, I hope everybody reprints it, called out the severity of what's happening in Gaza. You were not, the second piece, which took it to a different level, was not ignoring the first piece, and you labeled it as genocide, which again, I keep bringing the current atmosphere, they can arrest you for that. I mean, they've really, well, you shrug, but when people are being deported. How did you deport the student at Columbia who was involved in trying to have a peaceful demonstration? He didn't know, he's not accused of any crime. He's now locked up. He can't even be there for the birth of his child. All his freedom has been taken away. And his own university, which gave him his master's degree, was a good student, hasn't said a word in his defense. It's outrageous. And so we're talking about, look, the great irony, I am older than you, Dennis, so I was alive during the war. And as I said, I come from a mixed family where my father's family was the agency. Those people, the German people, good Christians, were the agency of killing a large number of Jews, obviously a grotesque genocide, but also tens of millions of other people. And the question out of the Second World War was, can it happen here? The big slogan was never again. And then, could it happen here? Because after all, Germany and the United States were very similar. German Americans were the largest immigrant group here in the United States. We admire Germany. It had the highest level of science. It was a society of considerable diversity, we thought, and a sense of law and order. And the irony that we are now considering an American fascism, And, you know, a lot of people are using that word not to just make noise, but, you know, calling serious attention. People who have studied the Holocaust, studied the rise of fascism, have called, and they're doing it in Israel as well, the horrible blood libel that somehow this is connected with Jewish survival, Jewish justice for Jewish people, security for Jewish people, and we would destroy freedom in the United States in the name of justifying what the Israeli government does. And if you dare question, I want to take it back to Congress. I want to keep, you know, we want to keep this and not take too much of your time. But at the heart of this is this is not McCarthyism. McCarthy was a lone senator without all that much support who was challenging the president of the United States, Dwight Eisenhower. He was challenging people who were running congressional committees who called him to task. We have a situation here where the United States Congress has basically denied that American citizens have the right to question the policy of another government, Israel.
Yeah. I will say that, you know, I'm not sure there isn't some parallel here. Are you now or have you ever been anti-Semitic? Yeah. I mean, you know, there is some kind of a ring to McCarthy's question.
This is worse than McCarthy because it's on the highest level. The U.S. Congress took this position that if you criticize a government, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish or what on what basis, and you know, you could have been Hannah Arendt or Albert Einstein. You know, I mean, there were a very large number of Jewish intellectuals in the world who have all along criticized policies of Israel. And in fact, you know, the man who did the most courageously to try to bring peace, Rabin, was killed by a Jewish fanatic who supported him, but some of them are in the Netanyahu government, so forth. So I want you know, you have a good sense of history.
It's a constitutional issue.
How alarmed are you?
It's a constitutional issue here. And I would submit to you that any and every law and policy which contravenes the First Amendment of the United States will eventually be turned down or overturned by the Supreme Court. It'll happen. The problem is the interim period. In addition to the First Amendment, which, as you point out, is freedom of religion and, of course, freedom of speech, you also have the vitiation of Fifth Amendment rights, of 14th Amendment rights. Due process is out the window. There has been the administration has moved so quickly that people were without a chance to defend themselves, and even habeas corpus goes out the window. You don't even have a chance to state your claim as a person. Now, I think that what we need to do is to understand there is symmetry here between that kind of conduct which is occurring in the United States and the violence that is being done to the people in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel does not have a First Amendment. They don't have a constitution per se. They have basic laws. The United States, the First Amendment, is the cornerstone on which all of our other rights depend. And yet, Congress, in its willingness to be sympathetic to Mr. Netanyahu's claims about what's happening in Israel, has gone in, you know, fully without asking the more basic questions. And it may be that Congress is not the place to be able to save the rights of the American people here. We're going to have to rely on the courts.
Including the People's House of Representatives.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the executive branch and the Congress, both elected, are not living up to their constitutional obligation here. Now, this has broader implications, which I want to put on the table right now. This is when we realize, when you start to add up the sum, the total of all of the justifications, the false justifications, of all the rationalizations, and of the policies themselves. This is absolutely the moment that we need to have a broader inspection of the United States' role in the world, and of the $1 trillion Pentagon budget, and of how that money is spent, and of the influence that think tanks and others have in apportioning that money as opposed to housing, education, healthcare, and all those other things that are relating to the practical aspirations of people. So I think that while we're in this discussion, we're riveted to this discussion of what about Israel? What about Gaza? What about Palestine? The bigger discussion here is what about the United States? What do we stand for? Who are we as a country? And why do we continue to wage war around the world? Why do we have 800 military bases? Why are we getting ready to, why are we even having a discussion in preparation for a war using nuclear weapons or attack on nuclear installations in Iran? What is going on in this country? We've lost the thread of democratic thought, of a republic. We are drifting here, and we're whistling through the graveyards of history, the 100 million people who perished in wars in the 20th century, most of them innocent civilian non-combatants. We think it can happen here. It's happening here. And we better stop this impulse, this maniacal, pathological impulse towards destruction, or we will be consumed by it.
And the rest of the world as well. I'm going to end on this, Dennis, but this is time. First of all, people want to get you right off the bat. It's in your Substack, right? How do they sign on? Or?
Just you don't get a free subscription at Dennis Kucinich at Substack. Just
okay.
Type and it in, you'll get there.
Yeah. And for those interested in having many different points of view, we also have share posts where they can read you. But I want to announce, I think I have your approval, and we're going to do this on a regular basis, right? Maybe there's a lot happening. And
I'd be honored to do that, Bob.
Yeah, you know, so like maybe every week if the times require it, we'll have the Bob and Dennis show here. Otherwise, as part of Shear Posts, I want to thank you for taking that time. I want to thank Joshua Shear, who once worked in your office, who is our executive producer and has followed your career ever since he was quite young. I want to thank Diego Ramos, who is our managing editor and writes these intros, Max Jones, who does the video, the JKW Foundation, memory of Gene Stein, a fiercely independent Jewish writer from an old Jewish family.
I knew her well.
Yes, and she dared very early on to say Palestinians, as with Jewish people, certainly was with Israelis, Jewish people have the right to survive and live and be free. And I want to thank Integrity Media, Len Goodman, someone also from an old Jewish family, for also giving us some funding to do this in the name of a free press. So we'll see you next week whenever it requires. We'll get Dennis back. And by the way, I realize there's a picture behind me. That's when I was interviewed Jimmy Carter when he was running for president. That was 76. When did I interview you?
78.
So 2 years later, I interview you when you were the mayor of Cleveland.
Just so your viewers won't think that I had a warm and fuzzy place in my heart for you, after I read the Carter interview, I said, I am not going to be interviewed by this guy. But I changed my mind when I saw the integrity of your work. So I appreciate it, Bob.
there was great integrity in your car. You know, it's ironic. The Carter interview got so much attention because he talked about lust in his heart and that, you know, he wasn't going to be this uptight, born again, you know, telling everybody how to live. But actually, in that interview, what was really going to be the news, I asked him, what kind of Democrat are you going to be? Are you going to be like what Lyndon Johnson did and get us into another Vietnam War? And he said, this was a quote, he said, I would never lie to the American people the way Lyndon Johnson did about Vietnam. And that, I thought, well, that was pretty explosive. Lady Bird Johnson, Lyndon Johnson was dead by that point. Lady Bird Johnson left the airport in Dallas, wouldn't meet him. That's where he was flying in. And I thought, wow, Jimmy Carter was a complex man because he did get us into some wars. Leaving that aside, we'll get back next week and see you then.